From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. If the American press is guilty of chasing after news real and imagined like a pack of slobbering wolves, then bolting off suddenly for fresh prey, the European papers are more like domesticated pets, obsessively shaking the same knot of rawhide day after day, month after month. And that obsession is American hegemony. Joining us once again to examine the latest twist in the rawhide is UPI chief correspondent Martin Walker, who says the European papers see trouble to the east and even more trouble to the Far East.
Well, the European press is really obsessed with two things. One has been the way in which they see the new North Korean nuclear crisis as casting real doubt upon the wisdom of the Bush administration focusing upon Iraq. And the other big theme has been the European outrage at the kind of pressure that was being put upon the European Union to bring in Turkey at its summit when it had the big enlargement, increasing the European Union by 10 new member states.
And the fear there that there is now a fox in the hen house, an Islamic State in the heart of Europe, or is it something more subtle than that?
Oh, it's much more subtle than that. I mean, if you look at the French press, it's clearly all an American plot. On the whole, the French and the German press are very, very suspicious of American and British pressure to bring Turkey into Europe. And on the other hand, the Spanish, the Italian, the British press tends to support the idea of bringing Turkey in part because they see it as a way of fending off the prospect of a clash of civilizations. And as the Times put it, by bringing in a moderate Islamic state like Turkey, Europe shows it is not a Christian club and is open to a much wider image of the world.
You mentioned the coverage of the burgeoning North Korea nuclear crisis, and it has gotten coverage here in the United States on page one, but surprisingly little vis-a-vis the build-up to a war with Iraq. Does that dominate the coverage in Europe and elsewhere in the world?
Well, it absolutely. I'm looking at, for example, the French Libération. In the last 2 days, North Korea has reminded the U.S. of its existence and placed America in a most embarrassing position, that of a superpower so obsessed with changing Iraq's regime that it's forgotten about the real priorities. Obviously, the danger now is North Korea. Berlin's Die Tagesspiegel, a very centrist paper, the Americans are clearly applying double standards. North Korea, with its nuclear policy, has so far not faced serious consequences, while Iraq is about to be attacked because of its weapons of mass destruction, which so far do not appear to approach the nuclear threshold. However, President Bush might enjoy Rupert Murdoch's British tabloid The Sun, which had a wonderful big editorial this week. When Bush branded Iran, Iraq and North Korea an axis of evil, the chattering classes scoffed. But Bush's warning was not just rhetoric. Now the world sees the proof of the threat presented by North Korea. The war on terror is most definitely not about the size of egos in the White House or Downing Street. It's a fight between good and evil, and good will win. I think President Bush would love that.
It sounds to me as if he may have written that. I'm bemused by the discovery, the shock that there is a double standard applied. Isn't geopolitics all about double standards? Where's the news there?
Well, except that, as I keep trying to sort of say on this program, one of the really curious and almost touching things is that the world does tend to expect better from the United States. We expect this sort of low cunning of realpolitik from the wicked old Europeans, but Americans are meant to be somehow rather purer, more idealistic, and rather more clear. And I've been looking at the Indian press. Here is the Hindu, a very centrist paper. American policy is confusing at best, crudely hypocritical at worst, and we expect better from the leader of the free world. That's putting it quite strongly. Curiously enough, the most waspish comment came from the Italian newspaper Il Giornale. For many observers, it's difficult to forget that at the present time, the main producer, user, and seller of ballistic missiles and cruise missiles is, in fact, the United States.
Please tell me, what is the verdict on 2002? Good year or bad year?
Well, the British weekly The Economist wrote a long editorial this week saying that, in fact, 2002 had been a great deal better year than we had any right to expect. There were bombs in Bali and in Kenya, but no huge 9/11 scale terrorist disasters. The world economy didn't collapse. It could have been worse.
Could have been better.
It could indeed.
Okay. Well, Martin, thank you very much. Happy New Year.
And to you.
Martin Walker is the chief correspondent for United Press International.
Early next week, the government in Hong Kong will unveil the draft of a new anti-subversion law. And over the last two Sundays, the measure has sparked huge demonstrations both in opposition and support. The crowd numbers are in dispute, but such protests are very rare in the streets of Hong Kong. The anti-subversion law is supposed to codify some loosely worded instructions in Hong Kong's mini-constitution. It has some grave implications for free speech and threatens to end the five-year experiment in, quote, one nation, two systems that has followed the former British colony's handoff to Chinese rule. Orville Schell, dean of the Journalism School at the University of California at Berkeley and a longtime China expert, joins us now. Welcome back to the show.
Pleasure to be back on it.
So what is Hong Kong's mini-constitution, and how does it relate to the one-country, two-systems idea?
Well, when Britain handed Hong Kong over to the mainland, they set up a thing called the Basic Law, which was, in effect, a constitution for Hong Kong, even though Hong Kong was going to be remanded to China and technically be under Chinese sovereignty. And one of the articles of that Basic Law said that at some time hence, the autonomous region of Hong Kong would have to enact a provision for national security that would cover things like treason, secession, sedition, and subversion. And last July, a former foreign minister said that it was time to do that. So in effect, you know, the Bigfoot in Beijing said, we want you to pass this legislation. And the Hong Kong government already has a reputation of being very much the creature of Beijing. So this is what set off the tension between the government or the autonomous region of Hong Kong and the people. And this is what brought people out into the streets. Was an amazing event. I mean, nothing like this has happened since 1989.
What about the consequences then for the press in Hong Kong? It was known at one time for being very free and vibrant, but we've noticed that that freedom seems to have drained away slowly since Hong Kong changed hands in 1997.
Everybody knew that everybody's economic bread in Hong Kong was buttered in China. And this meant that all the media outlets, the magazines, the newspapers were looking for advertisements from companies who were wanting to expand in China. So it was this that put a very chilling effect on the investigative ardor of newspapers, on the editorial ability of a broadcast outlet to take extreme positions, because they didn't want to antagonize the big oligarchs of Hong Kong who would have normally advertised with them. But I think that that, as much as outright censorship by the government, has been the dynamic that has been most profound in terms of its chilling effect on free expression in the media.
So have you noticed then this chilling effect in the Hong Kong media as it reacts to the news of the anti-subversion law?
Well, for instance, when these 60,000 people demonstrated against this Article 23, I think there was only one paper that put it on the front page. Now, what do you make of that? Well, I think it suggests that there is simply not a lot of sort of commercial advantage to be gained by covering stories that have a potentially sort of anti-China cast to them.
But what is it in the subversion law that actually would relate to the media? Would it actually make some subjects off limits?
Well, in the Chinese mainland scheme of things, to talk about the independence of Tibet as even a possibility, or the independence of Taiwan, or to feature the Falun Gong prominently in the press in a positive light, is considered seditious, illegal, and subverting of national security. So the fear is that if these things continue to be lofted in the Hong Kong press, that China might take umbrage, and because it is seditious under their scheme of things, ultimately lean on Hong Kong. And this fear is all the more real because when there are disputes, this would ultimately not be decided by the courts of Hong Kong, but would go all the way back to Beijing to the National People's Congress, which is basically a rubber stamp parliament and does the bidding of the Chinese Communist Party. So you see, this is the connection. This is where autonomy gets eroded, where fundamental decisions about what should be covered in the media in Hong Kong are not adjudicated in Hong Kong, but would be adjudicated back in Beijing. And this is what people fear.
Well, thanks a lot.
A pleasure.
Orabil Shell is the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley.
And now a few of your letters. 17-year-old Stephen Carroll from Washington State had this response to our piece on the controversy over the commercial in-school TV service, Channel One. "I watch Channel One every day," he writes, "and it is, in my opinion, one of the best news shows. It is educational, and the commercials are a mere side effect. These days, most people my age won't take the time to watch the news at home. The woman in Texas says Channel One is targeting children as consumers. Well, they are consumers. We all are."
Last week, we discussed a recent decision to allow a libel case to go forward in Australia, even though the reporting that sparked the suit originated in New York and was accessed on the Internet. Tom Betts writes, "Your guest from the Libel Defense Project expressed pessimism regarding the potential for a technical solution to prevent the delivery of information to countries with oppressive libel laws. In fact," he writes, "at least two companies already offer such a product. Quovis Geolocation and Envoy's Net Acuity. The use of such a service could serve as a defense against a provincial libel suit."
And finally, William Blevins of New York City sends us season's greetings. Thank you, William. Right back at you. And this note, referring to a sound effect we traced through several decades of movies, a sound effect called the Wilhelm. "Wilhelm has made the journey to Middle Earth," he writes. "During one of the sprawling battles in The Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers, I was stunned when I heard an orc being tossed through the air issue the familiar scream of the Wilhelm. Thanks to your show, I now find myself keeping my ears attuned for this cry."
Just as our ears are attuned to all of yours, please send your primal screams to us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. And don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. To hear our piece on the Wilhelm, just go to our website at onthemedia.org.
Coming up, some words on being an American writer for foreign ears only, and the flickering image of Uncle Tom.
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Here's a passage from an essay by the Arab-American writer Elmaz Abinader. "They circled me in the playground and shouted darky at my braids trying to explode into a kinky mop, or ape at my arms bearing mahogany hair against my pale olive skin." What's notable about the essay isn't the racially charged content, it's the venue, an anthology titled Writers on America, published by the U.S. State Department. The booklet, featuring the musings of such literary figures as Michael Chabon, Julia Alvarez, and Robert Pinsky, is officially propaganda, published explicitly to influence foreign audiences. It is also, therefore, by the terms of the Smith-Mundt Act, unpublishable here in the United States. Joining me now is the editor of Writers on America, George Clack. George, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
So it's absolutely impossible to get these essays in your hands if you're here in the States. There is no way that you can get around
the Smith-Mundt Act to read the works of Richard Ford and Julie Alvarez on the meaning of being an American writer?
Well, as I understand it, the law applies to State Department employees. It does not apply to American citizens. So if an individual citizen would have a copy of the book, there would be nothing preventing them from doing anything they want with it.
How about the web?
The way the lawyers have interpreted the prohibition to continue in the age of the Internet is that we do not provide the Internet URL, the web address, for any of our publications or any of our materials. And obviously, I can't provide that to you now.
But if I should happen to know it and put it on, say, the onthemedia.org website for anyone who would be interested in checking
it out. If you find out about it and you put it up, the law does not apply to you.
In this anthology are some of the most heralded writers America has to offer. Were you editing them as a literary editor or as a State Department official?
I would hesitate to seek to improve the prose of most of these people. That said, in a few cases, as a State Department employee, I was aware that there were some things that they said that you might be able to say to an American audience, and because of our cultural context, we would all understand what they mean, but that a foreign audience might see things in a different way. If, for example, a writer had been called some sort of racial epithet as a child and they put that into the essay, certain racial epithets I felt would trouble foreign audiences even more than they troubled me, and I managed to persuade the author that it would not be wise to run some of the more explicit material. My great concern was sort of the out-of-context usage of material from the book.
Are there any pieces in the anthology that I will be surprised that they were published by the State Department?
There's a number of essays that clearly point out that all is not perfect in American society. When we were putting out the essay, we believed pretty strongly that it is a strength to have different voices, that is, not State Department officials saying something, but private individuals, writers who are respected in their own right, saying what they want to say about America. We believe that it enhances the credibility of the product. When you read through this body of essays, you won't finish it and say, this has been a series of hymns to the greatness of America. I hope the sum total is that America's fundamental values are very sound values worth emulating, but you won't in every single essay feel that they're singing the party line by any means.
Do you think that the very fact that the State Department seal of approval will be on the cover of this book will disqualify its content in the eyes of the readers we're most interested in influencing?
I'm pretty confident that this book will get out and reach a lot of people and have some influence in the world. At the same time, I'm well aware that there is a segment of the world that is so against the idea of America that they will take this book and write their op-ed pieces and use it to basically say that the United States is trying to do something subversive and terrible through this book. But I still want to put out the book. I still want to give them that opportunity because I think getting these things into play in the public discussion is a worthwhile thing to do.
Very well. George Clack, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
George Clack is the executive editor of Writers on America. Nobody at the State Department needs to know, but you can link to excerpts from the essays from our site at onthemedia.org.
And now yet another effort to get the Arab world to like us. An armload of big-ticket Hollywood talent, including some of the folks who brought us Star Trek and The Shawshank Redemption, have signed on to bring American-style programs and, through them, American-style values to the Muslim world. The programs will be funneled through a nonprofit group called Al-Hakika, which means the truth in Arabic. It's led by former Reagan administration ambassador-at-large Richard Fairbanks and includes such diplomatic heavy hitters as James Baker, Lloyd Cutler, Henry Kissinger, and George Bush Sr. Now, when White House advisor Karl Rove went to Hollywood last year, prospecting for talent for much the same reason, the movers and shakers there soundly rebuffed him. But according to Ambassador Fairbanks, the creators of Al Hakika have had far more success in Tinseltown.
Well, we have been embraced for one good reason, and that is that we went to the working level, and we didn't go to the CEOs. We started having conversations with some of the producers and writers and directors who produce both the television and movies that are the world standard. They got excited on an individual basis, and we've been working with them as individuals.
I'm just wondering, we follow the foreign press pretty closely on this program, and it seems pretty clear that efforts by the Bush administration since 9/11 to improve America's image abroad have not gone very well. What do you think Al Hakika offers that the efforts by the younger Bush haven't been able to pull off?
Well, I think you have to give the administration a little more rope. And I think there's a new Undersecretary of State, Charlotte Beers. She and the Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, the President, they're thinking through ways to have the government do a better job.
But, Ambassador, it's precisely Charlotte Beer's efforts that seem to be slammed so roundly in the Arab press. So I ask again, what do you think Al Hakika will do that these other efforts haven't?
Well, we have a different idea. Obviously, we are a private sector. We're a not-for-profit. I think that will make it easier for us to be nimble, easier for us to get on the air quickly, and easier for us to have credibility and to appear on the local media, which people are already watching out there.
But you still have the same problem over there, getting onto stations where Arab nations can hear you and sending a message that they're willing to accept.
Well, no, that's where I think we don't have that problem that the government does. The government is thinking of trying to set up a new American television network. We, on the other hand, are planning to begin on the media that is already there, extant in the Arab world, and that is popular.
Now, I understand you've got something like a crossfire in the works, and another is a sitcom about a first-generation Arab-American family, sort of My Big Fat Greek Wedding in a Mosque. What other programs have you got going?
Well, I don't want to overpromise. We have a lot in the conception stage. We haven't begun any of them. We intend to have a program that would be like the old Route 66, that would have a couple of Arabs come to the United States, travel around, record their impressions of what life is like, and then a number of other dramas, some other sitcoms, and also a children's program, which we've been promised some assistance from the Children's Television Workshop.
Is there anything in the history of these efforts that really leads you to believe that the programs will result in a changed perception of America in the Muslim world?
No, this is no magic silver bullet. I know that there are a variety of people in the region. There are a variety of thoughts. That's why we're speaking with a variety of programming ideas. And there is no one affair which is going to change the view of the world as perceived in the Arab world of America. We are hoping to make a contribution to that, to make people think, and to provide a way of viewing the United States that is not available now.
What kind of timeline is involved here? Is it possible that your programs will coincide with a declaration of war on Iraq?
Well, we wouldn't, unfortunately, be able to be on the air that quickly if, as expected, a war were to begin this winter.
And if it is during or after the war, you're going to be facing a much longer and rockier road to improved public relations in the Middle East.
Well, not necessarily. Certainly depends on what kind of outcome we have if there were to be a war. We are not going to be able to walk away from that part of the world or any other part of the world. We're going to have to deal with it. And it seems to me that whether things are getting better or they're getting worse, this part of the world will still be important to us, and this effort is worth undertaking.
Well, Ambassador, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ambassador Richard Fairbanks is founder of Al Hakika Television and a former ambassador at large under President Reagan.
Al Hakika presents The New Route 66, the adventures of the sheltered Todd Sharif and streetwise but kind Buzz Malik, two Arab-American students taking a year off to explore the famous highway. We join our heroes fresh from their release from an Albuquerque holding cell where they were able to reconnect a world-weary prison guard with his alcoholic father. The boys are on their way to Amarillo, looking for some relaxation and a halal restaurant.
A tell you, Todd. I've been in local jails and holding cells up and down this dusty road, but that was the swinginest.
I could have done without the pork chops.
Uh-oh, Daddy-o, we got company.
That didn't take long. Buzz, let me do the talking this time.
It's a pretty nice vet you boys are driving.
Is there a problem, officer?
Well, son, it's like this. When the waitress in the restaurant two towns back asked if you want your tea hot or cold, what'd y'all say?
I said, gee, hot.
That's what she said, jihad. I'm afraid I'm going to have to take you in for some questions.
Join us next week as Todd and Buzz get roughed up by a teen who, it turns out, has a shocking secret in his past.
While America grapples with its image problem abroad, there are plenty of battles here at home, and race is a constant combat zone. Epithets like Uncle Tom are fired like bullets, most often by African Americans accusing each other of not being black enough. But the Uncle Tom in Harriet Beecher Stowe's novel is not the shuffling, submissive character most people picture when they hear that name. As the 150th anniversary of that landmark book draws to a close, WNYC's Allison Keyes offers this look at the fluctuating image of Uncle Tom.
17-year-old Anthony Jones, walking the halls of New York's Historical Society on a class tour, has never read the book Uncle Tom's Cabin, but he knows he'd be angry if someone called him an Uncle Tom.
If I don't know a person and they call me that, maybe, yeah, I'll get upset about it, yeah.
How come?
Because I know it's like, if someone called me that, that's like an insult, so I wouldn't like it.
Jones is walking through an exhibit called Reading Uncle Tom's Image, a reconsideration of Harriet Beecher Stowe's 150-year-old character and his legacy. The book Uncle Tom's Cabin is a story of a faithful slave who remains loyal to his master despite repeated betrayals. Stowe herself called it a series of sketches depicting the cruelty of slavery. The walls and display cases at the museum hold some of the 25 different early editions of the book and some editions from Germany and France. Pictures of Uncle Tom himself are seen on everything from playing cards to garishly decorated gold leaf vases. Sometimes he's a bent elderly man in his 60s, and sometimes he's a strong, virile man in his early 20s. There are also posters from vaudeville plays, with Uncle Tom portrayed as a shuffling buffoon by whites in blackface makeup. Kathleen Hulster curated this exhibit and says the Uncle Tom seen on stage was definitely not the Uncle Tom in Stowe's book.
The Uncle Tom in the book, for one, is not described as old. He's described as strong and manly and noble. He has young children. He's not bent and gray. Harriet Beecher Stowe writes Uncle Tom as a Jesus kind of figure. The novel is set in a religious framework, and he's very, very clearly seen as someone who suffers, has many tribulations, and is ennobled by his death at the end.
But most people are more familiar with the cowardly Uncle Tom from the minstrel shows than they are with Stowe's book, says University of California at Davis African Studies professor Patricia Turner. She says the stage version was popular from 1852 until well into the 20th century.
The producers of the stage shows, which were called Tom shows, didn't share Stowe's passion against slavery. So they took the basic novel and they turned it into a musical, they turned it into a comedy, they took that robust black strapping male and turned him into an older man. They eliminated all of the references to the horrors of slavery and replaced them with images of dancing darkies on the plantation.
Turner says those who think Uncle Tom is a coward are unaware of the sacrifice he makes at the end of the book.
He dies because he is unwilling to tell Simon Legree where some runaway female slaves are hiding, women that he knows Legree intends to sexually exploit.
And that's very different from what happened on stage, where Uncle Tom is detached from the whole rhetoric of anti-slavery, and his death is made to seem as an example of his wishy-washiness and his unwillingness to fight back, instead of as an example of his incredible Christian heroism.
Not only was the novel one of the earliest bestsellers, the merchandising surrounding the book was extraordinary for the time period. There were toys and statues and songs, even a topsy-turvy doll with the black slave Topsy on one side, then, when its skirts were flipped, little Eva on the other side. Professor Turner, author of Ceramic Uncles and Celluloid Mammies, Black Images and Their Influence on Culture, says the book so invaded the black psyche that it sparked a flurry of responses from writers of color ranging from Frederick Douglass in the 19th century to the present.
We've got Richard Wright's Uncle Tom's Children. Ralph Ellison even makes reference to Uncle Tom's Cabin in terms of talking about the publication and what inspired him to write Invisible Man. Even more recently in the 1990s, Robert Alexander, a black playwright, wrote a play called I Ain't Your Uncle, The New Jack Revisionist Uncle Tom's Cabin.
The image of Uncle Tom was depicted in comic books, movies, and even a 1947 MGM cartoon by Tex Avery called Uncle Tom's Cabana. In this cartoon, which once was seen in movie theaters by audiences of all ages, Uncle Tom tries to save his popular nightclub from the evil Simon Legree. In this version, Uncle Tom wins.
Then all of a sudden, he chased me up that Empire State Building and pushed me right off the top. Fall down 14 miles and get on the pavement. And right there is where I get mad. I grab up that Empire State Building with Legree up there on top, and I throws him clean over the moon. That was the end of Mr. Legree.
Standing in front of a huge poster from the movie Superfly, which hangs across the hall from a poster from Muhammad Ali's movie The Greatest, and a large picture of Black Panther Party head Huey Newton, Hulser talks about how viscerally the image of Uncle Tom has affected blacks.
By the 1970s, there was beginning to be an answer to that old screen movie image of the bent, meek, obsequious man. And the movie answer to that was really movies like Superfly, these blaxploitation pictures which had wonderful, strong, young, virile African-American heroes in them doing active, thrilling things. So there's a sense in which this genre of movies is really an answer to that old stage and movie image of an old, desexualized, and powerless man.
Professor Turner says as more people actually read the book, there are select audiences that are getting a more complete view of who Uncle Tom actually was, as written by Stowe. But Professor Turner says there may come a day when blacks take being called an Uncle Tom as a compliment, not an insult.
And I've been waiting for someone to say when they've been accused of being an Uncle Tom, well, you know, that may not be the worst thing to be accused of. I would like to be associated with someone who would give their life rather than see members of my race sexually exploited.
For On the Media, I'm Allison Keyes.
Next up, everything you need to know about war reporting, from sat phones to flak suits to battle fatigue.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. America's military operations in Afghanistan offer a preview of what coverage from the battleground in Iraq might be like. Miniaturization and satellite technology enabled reporters to reach military operations, successful and unsuccessful, they never could have reached before. But new technology brings both greater opportunity and more risks. Stephen Livingston is a senior research fellow at the University of Washington's Center for American Politics and Public Policy. He recently reviewed the new technology available to war correspondents, and he joins me now. Professor Livingston, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you. Well, let's start with the obvious question. How has technology changed in the past 11 years?
Technology has made reporters far more mobile and in a measure uncontrollable. Obviously, a good place to begin as a point of comparison is the nature of reporting in 1991 and the nature of reporting in 2002. CNN, of course, made tremendous strides in using technology in 1991. Peter Arnett used an MRSAT satellite phone to offer audio reports. If we think back, one of the things that we saw often was a picture of Arnett tethered to a rather large satellite phone. A new MRSAT phone can run off the batteries in the device itself, as opposed to the generator that was required to operate Arnett's satellite phone 11 years ago.
It's my understanding that the Iraqi government is not all that keen on letting satellite telephones and digital cameras and small laptop editing systems into the country for reporters to use during the coverage of the war. How do you sneak this by the border agents who are greeting the American reporters?
There are interesting stories that actually came out of the war in Kosovo. There were certain instances, such as an American aircraft hit a convoy in 1999 of refugees. And we found in that instance, when the Serbs took the journalists on a tour of the site where this unfortunate event occurred, all of a sudden satellite phones came out of various pieces of luggage all over the bus, and the Serbs turned a blind eye to the availability of pieces of equipment that were banned from use. Something like that may also happen in Iraq if, for example, there is a collateral damage incident. The Iraqis may have a sudden change of heart about the ability of Western news crews to broadcast images that they think are to their strategic advantage.
Well, that makes sense. But what about in the first instance of letting this stuff in the country?
A lot of this stuff looks like a laptop computer. Now, this isn't to say that the Iraqis aren't interested in controlling laptop computers, but the difference between getting an MRSAT Mini-M, or which is a small satellite phone, or getting even newer generation MRSAT phones in, and is a much different proposition than trying to get a C-band or Ku-band satellite uplink, which fills much of a balcony, and this is the sort of thing that was used in 1991. It required permission to get it through. It was $50,000 or plus dollars just to ship the equipment there. So the difference today is that if you can stick the equipment in a bag, get it through customs, that's a relatively much easier proposition.
Do you think that the miniature nature of this material and the temptation for news organizations essentially to smuggle them behind enemy lines will lead to espionage arrests and trials of the sort that we've seen a few of, but not many of, in military engagements over the last decade or two?
Sure. There were at least two correspondents who were arrested by the Taliban for espionage. So that is certainly a possibility. This is something we should keep clearly in mind, that on the one hand, technologies such as the video phone or satellite broadcasting more generally that's smaller, more mobile, offers the possibility of covering things from a different perspective than before. On the other hand, to do that, journalists are going to be putting themselves in tremendous risk.
All right, Stephen Livingston, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Stephen Livingston is a senior research fellow at the University of Washington's Center for American Politics and Public Policy.
The American military trains its troops to win wars with elaborate and expensive combat simulations. The same war games also give the military a chance to work on winning the media war, too, one reporter at a time. WNYC's Fred Mogul reports.
We need a quiet back here. Continue to track current operations.
The 1st Brigade of the 10th Mountain Division is planning an assault on Shugart Gordon, a 30-building village in the mythical Republic of Cortina. Reporters and news crews prowl for interviews at the brigade headquarters, a cluster of tents covered with camouflage netting and surrounded by steep berms of mud. a team from WNN, the World News Network, is looking for a senior officer to lay out the attack plan. Instead, they get a junior enlisted man.
What is an intel analyst and what do you do?
Mostly my job is to keep the commander and the three-shop informed of what's going on in the battlefield, sir.
Okay, what's a three-shop?
Three-shop are operation shop, sir.
Acting reporter Doc Moulton is interviewing specialist Ernest Stieg, a tall 21-year-old intelligence analyst from Orlando, Florida.
What's it like to be in the Army, learning all this new stuff, and then suddenly you're deployed thousands of miles away to a third-world country like Cortina?
The only thing I think is accomplish the mission faster I can get my mission done, help my unit get their mission done sooner we can get back home, sir.
Off to the side stands Major Michael Indovina, an Army Public Affairs Officer, or PAO. He's taking notes, and after the interview, he gives Specialist Stee an after-action review.
I always like to start with positive. Did a good description of what your job was. You told them without worrying about going into operational security and getting into major details. You started going with a lot of the jargon. Just remember, the reporters have no idea what the S3 is, so you have to explain all that stuff to them. So
reporters generally don't want supervisors watching them do interviews, but the WNN team doesn't mind at all. That's because they're not really a news crew. They're part of the Army Public Affairs Office. And Cortina isn't really an American ally besieged by insurgents. It's a large swathe of forest, field, and swamp, otherwise known as the Joint Readiness Training Center at Fort Polk, Louisiana. What WNN is really covering is a sophisticated million-dollar-a-day game of laser tag involving more than 5,500 soldiers.
Public affairs is an important part of the battlefield.
Public affairs is an important part of the battlefield, Major Indovina says, driving a Humvee across bumpy dirt roads. In wartime, the media keeps a lot of people informed, the soldiers, the public back home, and even the enemy. Still, the media and the military do operate at cross purposes, and they often skirmish. Gil Meyer, a retired two-star general, was the Army's top public affairs officer during the late 1990s.
The skepticism between the military and the media is always going to be there. We have two diametrically opposed organizations. The media wants freedom. The military wants control. And my answer to both sides is just get over it.
A certain amount of hostility is healthy, says the Washington Post's veteran military reporter, Tom Ricks.
It should be an adversarial relationship. The Founding Fathers, in their wisdom, set up an adversarial system in which parts of major American institutions go at each other hammer and tong. That's why you have three competing branches of government. The American media is uniquely powered under our Constitution and also engages in that kind of adversarial conduct. Now, you do it respectfully. I like and admire a lot of the people I cover, but I am constantly aware that it is and was structured to be adversarial.
Ricks concedes that some reporters are sensationalistic and unsophisticated, but he also thinks the military's training encourages anti-media paranoia. Some of the fictional news crews he's seen are absurdly, unrealistically aggressive. That's not a problem at Fort Polk, where today's WNN crew is more Larry King than Mike Wallace, more lapdog than Pitbull. Here's Doc Moulton trying to wheedle information out of Command Sergeant Major Francisco Apontortiz.
So how many soldiers have you lost in this conflict so far?
In this conflict? I cannot discuss that at this time.
Why is that?
You have to be with my PAO. Where's my PAO at? Back there. He'll be able to give you more information on that.
Afterwards, Apontortiz congratulates himself for evading the mock journalist.
I know he tried to slick one in there about the number of personnel, casualties, injury. And, of course, I cut that one a mile away. Yeah.
Sometimes he's good about giving the WNN crew canned statements from the official mission guidelines.
We're doing well over here. The soldiers are very motivated. We're doing just fine and looking forward to go home for Christmas.
And other times, he surprises with a candid, critical comment.
I believe the old soldiers back in 1979 when I actually came into the service were actually more motivated, better disciplined.
The stories are legion of soldiers and officers speaking their minds to the media and putting their career at risk. Captain Cheryl Vermilion, a Black Hawk helicopter pilot, says she learned the value of reticence the hard way.
I went on a deployment to Central America, and we had media down there, and some of the answers that some people gave got a whole bunch of people in trouble.
So, what happened?
we were joking around and media was there and they caught it and said we got in trouble with command at home. So, no, I am very aware of the media. I am very cognizant of what they can do.
You say cognizant. Are you concerned that we can manipulate or...
Yes. I think the media is very important. I think it's great. I mean, I watch CNN just like everybody else. That's how I get a lot of my own information. So I think it's a wonderful tool. It's just always in the back of my mind, be careful of what happens because we've been burned once before. So.
The officers of the 110th Aviation Battalion stand well away from the microphones, watching their peers interview with the World News Network. They joke among themselves about how they'd really like to answer the questions. For many reporters, this sort of unrehearsed scene would be the whole point of the story, the place where you find out what's really on the minds of the soldiers who will fight the country's next war. For the media trainers of WNN, though, the point is 10-second soundbites, and that's what they're here to help the soldiers deliver. For On the Media, I'm Fred Mogul.
Is a Force That Gives Us Meaning is the title of a new memoir by Chris Hedges, a New York Times reporter who has spent most of his professional career dodging bullets. Shot at in Kosovo, expelled from Central America, taken captive in Iraq, Hedges expounds on the myth-making that ensues in wartime among politicians, soldiers, and reporters. The myths are hard to comb out when the fight is our own, he says. It's far easier to report without illusions on someone else's war.
Well, when you're covering a conflict, let's say Bosnia, where your nation is not involved, you can report on the horror that is war. I mean, I think most people looked at the Bosnian conflict or the conflict in Kosovo and saw it for the ugly, horrific mess that it was. But when you go into the Persian Gulf War, you know, especially with video clips that were handed to the broadcast media by the military, and then all of the restrictions. I mean, you couldn't take photographs of the bodies coming back, of the coffins coming back from Dover and this kind of stuff. It was so stage managed, and the press went along with it, that war became a vast video arcade game. So when your own nation is involved in war, when you feel you are under assault, then you imbibe... You imbibe in the myth.
And in your book, you suggest that during the Gulf War, the press wanted to be used. It saw itself as part of the war effort. That's not what a lot of journalists have told this program.
Well, I would disagree with them. If the press had not administered that pool system and they ran it, deciding who would go where on which day, it couldn't have functioned. There was a complete collusion between the military and the press. And I think the fact is, which is true in every conflict I've been in, the vast majority of those people did not want to go out. They don't say that publicly, but I believe that that was true.
You had to look inward to write this book. What did you find inside yourself?
It's a kind of addiction. You know, I jumped from war to war to war for almost 2 decades. It was no accident that I was covering the war in Kosovo with people I had covered the war in Central America with 20 years before.
How did you justify going to war after war after war, seeing the other same correspondents there in the field over and over again?
I mean, I thought what was happening in Sarajevo was a crime. I still think it was a crime. You know, I went there because I was outraged, and the same reason I went to El Salvador when the death squads were killing 800 to 1,000 people a month, and that hasn't changed. I mean, there was a very idealistic streak that drove me to these conflicts. In Kosovo, I still believe the work that we did was good. The Serbs would go into a village and kill Kosovar Albanians and block all the roads, and we'd walk in and get it. Now, coupled with that was the adrenaline rush, was the sort of intoxication with the whole milieu of war and the exaltation of ourselves, and I mean, all of that stuff. I mean, motives are always mixed, but that's how I justified it, and I think others justified it. I think what we're less honest about is talking about how this kind of a lifestyle can become an addiction. You know, the rest of life seems rather trivial and dull and slow. You know, Freud called it the notion of the uncanny, where everything familiar becomes strange. And, I mean, you have that. And you miss that fraternity. I mean, that, you know, there is a fraternity of war correspondents. And you sort of long to get back into the conflict. Combat soldiers have this as well.
You've hung it up. You had some turning point, some Rubicon. You decided you would cross and not go to war anymore. What was it?
It was gradual. I'm not sure it was one thing. I got caught about a year or two ago in a very bad ambush in Gaza, in Netzarim, and a young 19-year-old kid about 10 feet from me was shot through the chest and killed. I lost my closest friend in Sierra Leone. I lost two friends, one of whom I was very close with, Kurt Schork. They were killed in an ambush. I mean, these aren't the first people I've worked with who died, but I think I realized that if I didn't step back and stop, you know, my luck was going to run out. Nobody stays lucky forever.
How long have you been away from it now?
I was in Gaza, I guess it was a year ago, so a year or two.
Are you feeling some of the effects that you described?
No, I think that I've pretty much washed my hands of it, and I've spent 3 years doing that. I think there'll always be a kind of nostalgia for it. There's a passage in the book about friends of mine in Sarajevo sitting around after the war, and they're lamenting, you know, the fullness that that experience gave them. They had a sense of purpose, a sense of ennoblement. You know, they were able, through war, to rise above the sort of petty concerns of daily life and become engaged in something epic. And I think one also has to remember that there is this huge communal sense that we have in wartime, and it allows us to suspend individual conscience. Suddenly we all know what the goal is. This is all powerful stuff, and you even saw it after 9/11. There was a kind of nostalgia in the city for that kind of glow.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chris Hedges is a New York Times investigative reporter and author of War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, with Megan Ryan and Emily Ford, engineered by Rob Christensen, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Sharon Ball, Bernardo DePaula, Rex Stone, Paul Chufo, and Scott Strickland, and of course vital assistance from Natasha Kurganker, to whom we reluctantly say goodbye this week. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer, and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Happy New Year.
From all of us to all of you.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Beidel Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.